It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strandchamps. Let's play a game.
We are now...
Ooh, I like the noise. Yeah.
We are waiting to be born. Okay, and now we've been born.
You're crying. I'm playing this new online game with my producer, Mark Rickers. It's called 1 Hour, One Life. We start as a helpless baby and try to stay alive. You're starving.
Oh, boy. So I died of starvation. Okay. I guess we'll try again.
Yeah. This is the latest from the independent game designer, Jason Rohrer, and it's not like other games.
It's a multiplayer game. It's on a server. An infinite world of wilderness that's untouched by human hands so far. And the first person who joins the server is plopped down in the middle, but with a lightning bolt, kind of, as Eve, the first human being in this world. Subsequent players that join the server are born as a helpless baby to some other player who's already in the world. So, like, player two who joins the game will be Eve's first baby, and so on.
Oh, boy.
You're crying again.
Oh, she
You're
picked
a new
me
baby.
Up. So she's consoling me.
Oh, look, she said you are strong.
Oh,
she says you're the only girl.
I need you to live.
She just said, I need you to live. See?
As people grow up in the game, they get old enough, they can finally have a baby of their own, which is another player coming into the game. And everyone lives for an hour before they get old and die, with each minute that goes by marking a passing year of your life. But, you know, a lot of people don't live the full hour because they are attacked by a wild animal or starved to death or have some other calamity happen to them.
She
oh,
said,
no.
She said, shit.
Please don't die. Okay. It's what every parent wants for their children. Please don't die. Is this, can I eat this? Nope.
It's a basket
That's
of
a
eggs.
Basket of eggs. That's grown-up food. Oop.
You died.
Yep.
Oh. See, I feel so bad for that woman. She told you to stay alive. In 1 hour, one life, the only way you can survive even the first 3 minutes is if another player, a stranger, adopts you, which is kind of like the gamer's equivalent of a trust fall. It's a surprisingly powerful experience, and that's what Jason Rohrer is famous for designing. His games are like social experiments, and this time, with this game, he's betting against cynicism and for love. Jason, I wound up feeling surprised and sort of humbled by the kindness of strangers, in that over and over again, here I am, this helpless baby plopped down on the ground in front of them, and yeah, they pick me up and feed me and keep me alive.
Yeah, so that was what I thought would happen, but people told me ahead of time that this was never going to work. A lot of people talk about how horrible players are to each other in these online games, trolling each other or being rude to teammates, bad-mouthing each other and all this kind of stuff. So with that as a backdrop, I'm saying I'm going to make a game where players are going to care for each other and they're going to be strangers and they're not going to know each other. Like, what? That's never going to work. Every baby's going to die. This is never going to get off the ground. But the fundamental aspects of this game are that you only live an hour, but you have these children and grandchildren who will live for a very long time and potentially have more children and grandchildren who can make use of what you did during your lifetime. They're the only thing that gives life meaning in the game, right? And so players quickly figure this out, right? If they let their babies die and they don't take care of them, everything they do is essentially lost.
I'm trying to figure out how to convey what that feels like emotionally, because when you're born and some other woman picks you up and says, you're our miracle.
Yes.
I mean,
you might
a woman
be.
Did that. You're yes. our miracle. And then she said, it's just her and her older son left in this village. I was the only girl. They were really happy to have a girl.
Yes, because that's the only way they could have another baby.
No, they loved me.
Yeah, well, yeah. No, okay. So this is the interesting thing about this, right? The feelings that you have in the game feel very similar, if not identical, to some of the feelings that we have in real life for our relatives and parents and so on. I mean, you don't have as much time for the bond to develop, but this feeling that you have feels very like, wow, that feels kind of like I love this little baby. Like, what's going on here?
Yeah.
It's like this isn't just feel-good nonsense. It's the nuts and bolts of human reality.
Well, it's the basis of civilization. You've created one of these worlds where people are starting from scratch with nothing much except trees and grass. People are beginning to turn this world into a civilization, and the thing that is making it work, that's powering it, is love and cooperation. It's sort of beautiful.
Yeah, rolling back, though, it's interesting to say, like, well, look at all these other experiences, right? Like Twitter or all these online games where people are so horribly to each other. Comment sections, maybe even on NPR, people probably get snarky with each other, right?
Oh, yeah.
So is that human nature, which is what most people would say? And I might have thought that before, too. And I tried this experiment in this game, 1 Hour, One Life. And for the most part, people do care for their babies. I mean, there's these huge family trees, you know, families that have lasted generations and so on. Well, the record in the game so far is, I think, 228 generations.
Oh, my God.
Which went over,
really?
Like, 4 days. Yeah. There's a family tree browser that tracks who their children were with little portraits of everybody and their last words and how long they lived and what they're maybe struggling with. Like, they'll be saying, you know, food running out, or, oh, no, here comes a bear. And then you see three of them die with bear attacks or something.
I was also born a couple of times as an Eve, a young woman. So I would just be in the middle of wilderness, basically, and there I am. And it was nice not to be a helpless infant. But then I started having babies. And honestly, it never would have occurred to me to just abandon the baby. But I do think I might have survived longer if I had.
Right. You know, more advanced players will actually apologize to the baby before walking away.
Oh.
Sorry, there's no food here. I'm looking, but I'm doing my best. And there are some people who come into the game trying to screw things up.
Really?
In the world of video games, they're called griefers.
Because that's what they do. They cause grief.
They cause grief. People are trying to grow one kind of crop, and you plant a different crop. They're trying to make a wall, and you kind of dig up the foundation of the wall when they're not looking. It's possible to murder each other in the game.
You're ruining my vision of this wonderful cooperative world in which everybody loves little babies and cares for each other.
Yeah, so this is the other fundamental big question that this game asks. As a civilization or society, we have to come up with laws and rules and this sort of code of conduct, right, for what's allowed and what's not. And how did that develop? Where did that come from? Why do people have that? How did we settle on these rules? I'm trying to set up a system in this game where players can go through the process of figuring that out.
Jason, the press release that came with your game said something like, I'm designing a game that will make people say, I love you and mean it. Can you explain? What did you mean by that?
So in 1 Hour, One Life, I have observed people say, I love you to each other in the game. Oftentimes, people will say it at the end of their life in the game when they're an elderly person and they're looking over their children and grandchildren and getting ready to leave because they're going to die soon. They will often kind of walk around to everybody and kind of say goodbye and tell them that they, you know, I love you all or whatever. And then oftentimes, there's also this kind of love talk that happens between mothers and babies. Sometimes the first word a baby will say once it can say three characters is L-U-V. And I've said it myself in the game when I'm playing. And it doesn't feel like I'm making it up or just going along with it. It feels like it's coming out of me from a kind of a real place. So if we want to unpack it just slightly more, it's interesting that if you strip people of their identities, then you can kind of tap into their souls a little bit more, maybe. If you put people behind like a little cartoon avatar that looks like a little person, and you give them a very limited bandwidth with which to talk and interact, like this little chat bubble that comes up above their heads and can only say very simple things, then you don't really know too much about them, right? Given demographics, most of those people who were your mother were probably like 13-year-old boys. And when you stop to think about that, if you were to hear their voices, it would ruin it for you, right? So you're kind of interacting soul to soul with this other person.
Wow. That's beautiful. That explains why I'm still thinking about my mother and my brother Ulrich from that little village.
We were both 13-year-old boys.
Well, they were lovely.
With cracking prepubescent voices.
And they felt maternal, and they looked after me. Anyway.
First game to make 13-year-old boys feel maternal.
This whole thing seems sort of beautiful and also kind of heartbreaking, but hopeful also. Where do you fall on the, if there's a sort of spectrum from cynical and pessimistic at one end to optimistic and hopelessly romantic on the other?
Yeah. It's,
where
it's,
do you fall?
It's tough. I think that maybe, like, if I just lay out the facts, right? Like, the facts, as far as I'm aware about the nature of our solar system or whatever, is that everything is actually doomed. Like, literally, like, not just like, will I leave a legacy for the next generation, or will this book that this person wrote still be readable in 100 years or 1,000 years? It's like, we'll go out 50 billion years and there's nothing left. And there's no trace of humanity left. There's no trace of the Earth left. Once the sun supernovas and swallows everything up, and who knows what's going to happen after that, right?
Okay, that's cheery.
Thinking on those terms, it's like, wow. Then the moment is all that we really have. And the moment, if you stop and appreciate it and kind of absorb it while it's happening, it does feel like it itself is infinite sometimes.
And miraculous.
Yeah.
Maybe I'd call you a romantic realist then.
Romantic realist.
Jason,
do you realize how lucky we are to get to take part in this miraculous, doomed thing that's happening around us? It's amazing.
It is. It is. Thank you for making games that help us feel that.
Yes, thank you.
Jason Rohrer is an independent game designer. His work is part of the Museum of Modern Art's permanent collection, and we were talking about his latest, called 1 Hour, One Life. By the way, we put our very own Let's Play of the game, where you can watch Mark and me playing badly, on our website. That's at ttbook.org. We're making the case against cynicism and for sincerity this hour. I have to tell you, I came very close to editing out that last exchange I had with Jason. I guess I was afraid it would come across as too earnest, just cloyingly sincere. I worried you'd make fun of me. But why? When did we become so uncomfortable with sincerity and so comfortable with the sarcastic tone and the cynical voice and the ironic nudge? Christy Wampole has been thinking about that too.
I'm a Gen Xer, and I think Gen X millennials and now Gen Z, or whatever you want to call them, we've all grown up with this. I always had sort of ironic t-shirts and magnets on the refrigerator.
Empathy is when you feel what someone else is feeling. Do you understand?
Feel someone else?
Watching Beavis and Butthead, Mystery Science Theater 3000, all of these shows that are about how do we make fun of culture that came before us.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Satellite of Love. I've asked Joel if he'd raise the level on my sarcasm sequencer.
South Park is another good example. These sort of cartoons that suddenly became for adults.
Cartman, I feel really bad for you, honestly. No, you don't! I'm sorry, I gotta go home.
We were kind of born into this and conditioned with it. The problem is when that irony seeps out into everyday life.
He does feel bad for you, Carmen. He just thinks it's ironic.
Christy Wampole is a French professor. She writes a lot of cultural criticism. And in 2012, she wrote a New York Times column called How to Live Without Irony. And if you read the comments, it seemed like every hipster everywhere instantly hated it. Electric Lit's reviewer said it made him want to poop in his hat. Luckily, that wasn't the only reaction. Now, after President Trump was elected, Wampole wrote a follow-up on Living Without Irony, subtitled For Real This Time. Steve Paulson got together with her to talk unironically about irony.
When you talk about it seeping into everyday life, give me some examples of what you mean.
The thing that originally inspired me to write the article, I was in Berlin at the time, and I was staying in this sort of very hip area that summer, and out the window there were only American hipsters, and I was reading Dostoevsky's The Idiot, which is about Prince Myshkin, who lacks any trace of irony in his behavior and his speech, and then out the window I was hearing the exact opposite. Every phrase that came out of the mouths of the Americans downstairs were hyper-ironic, and you see it on television, you see it in commercials, that nothing quite means exactly what it says that it means, and there's a gap between what something seems to be and what it's really saying, and so that's what compelled me to originally write the piece, and I was really shocked the response that I got from that, and that people even now still write to me about it.
Shocked in what way?
That I somehow managed to put into words what many people had been feeling. I especially got a lot of mail from younger people who said that at school, many of them were high school students or university students, that when they try to express something in a sort of sincere way, that they're made fun of, or that there's some kind of joke that comes along with their expression of sincerity, and that they were really tired of hiding behind it.
Mm-hmm. Let me give you an example of this from my son, who's now in college, but when he was in high school, he would come home and talk about his day. And describing the experience of being in a big public high school, he had to put his armor on to get through an average day. He said the teasing, the mocking was relentless. You always had to be ready with a quick comeback. If you showed any vulnerability, any sincerity, you would get eaten alive.
I think it's true. And if you get a group of young people in a room and you start talking about this problem, and somehow you signal that, okay, in the space of this room, you can let your guard down for a moment, it just comes flooding out how hungry people are for an irony-free interaction with another human being. Why is the default mode the ironic mode? Could we imagine a different default mode?
Right.
Really sort of soaked with irony.
Mm-hmm. So the hipster, I suppose, is the quintessential example of what you're talking about. The guy who's turned kitsch into an art form, into a lifestyle. Nothing is taken seriously. Everything is an in-joke.
It's true, but I noticed this pattern far beyond the hipster scene. Where I didn't find it is among people who really are having a hard time making ends meet. People who are really worried about whether they will be able to pay rent. People who are worried about being deported. People who have this kind of heaviness that lingers in their lives every day.
You're saying irony comes out of privilege.
I think so.
Yeah, if you have a safe, privileged life, you can afford to be ironic.
Absolutely.
So what's the deeper problem here? Okay, people are kind of making fun of everything. They don't really take anything seriously. Why is that so bad?
Well, after the election, I wrote another piece called How to Live Without Irony for Real This Time, where I talk about that, you know, this ironic tendency tends to proliferate often on the left. And this forfeiting of the voice through this kind of unseriousness, I think, resulted in part with the outcome of the election.
You put it bluntly. You say that the age of irony ended abruptly with Donald Trump's election.
Yes. Suddenly, there seemed to be a kind of wake-up call. I mean, I obviously spent a lot of time on campuses and with students. And students that I had seen on campus who weren't particularly politically engaged or politically interested suddenly felt this kind of urgency and that luxury of making everything silly and duplicitous in an ironic way.
Do you think irony is a form of cynicism?
I do. I think it's an admission of a kind of defeat. It comes from the same place that a political apathy comes from.
In other words, you don't really believe in anything. You're not willing to commit to anything. You're above it all.
I think so. It allows for a kind of critical distance that doesn't let you be touched by a problem.
So let's pull back from the political sphere and talk about what all of this means in our own lives. What does it mean to live without irony, or at least with less irony?
Something I wrote about in the first article was that when I give gifts to people, I tend to give ironic gifts. And I was trying to analyze that. Why is it easier for me to give someone, even someone I care deeply about, an ironic gift rather than something that comes from a place of sincerity?
What would be an example of an ironic gift?
Some kind of silly trinket or a coffee mug with a kind of ridiculous slogan on it, or, you know, all of these junk gifts and junk merchandise that are omnipresent. Why was I giving these presents? Whenever you'd make any kind of sincere gesture toward another person, there is a bit of risk involved that the person will misunderstand.
You're exposing some vulnerability. I mean, you're showing that you care.
Yes. And I think the internet has obviously had a lot to do with this omnipresent attitude of irony. And all it takes is 3 minutes on Twitter, on Facebook, on YouTube to detect it. You have to be the person with the wittiest comment. And then, of course, news reports on witty comments as though they're news.
Yeah. So what about you? Have you banished irony from your own life?
I try to use it sparingly. I like spending time with older people for whom this is still quite alien in many ways. I still have both of my grandmothers. absolutely not a trace of irony in their speech. And I know that when I'm with them, I can engage with them in a way, in an irony-free way. Because when I switch to this language, I mean, it really is its own kind of language. They kind of stare at me as though I'm from somewhere far away.
Right.
First of all, I spend a lot of time with people who don't have that tendency, and I sort of try to select my friends based on that. I've tried to remove all of the irony from my surroundings, from my clothes. Now I'm pretty careful about choosing these things, and I like it. I mean, I try to spend more time reading than online or watching TV or whatever. Going out into nature, for example, nature is the most non-ironic space that one can be in. There is no irony in trees. There's no irony in the mountains. So I try to spend a lot of time outside. It starts to sound very monastic. You know, how do you remove yourself from all of these influences? But if you think about the monastic origins of universities, I think it makes sense that I would be attracted to a place like that.
Christy Wampole talking with Steve Paulson. She's a French professor at Princeton, and you can find both her essays, How to Live Without Irony and How to Live Without Irony for Real This Time, on our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, on the one-year anniversary of the deadly Charlottesville rally, we talk with a former skinhead about the redemptive power of love. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. From Wisconsin Public Radio, NPRX. We're making the case against cynicism in this hour. And so what exactly does it mean to be cynical? Well, I looked it up. The dictionary definition is not trusting or respecting the goodness of other people. There's a lot of that going around, huh? Let's pick one example. White supremacy.
To be white is to be a striver, a crusader, an explorer, and a conqueror. We build, we produce, we go upward. And we recognize the central lie of American race relations. We don't exploit other groups. We don't gain anything from their presence. They need us and not the other way around. America was, until this past generation, a white country designed for ourselves and our posterity. It is our creation. It is our inheritance, and it belongs to us. Hail Trump! Hail our people! Hail victory!
That's Richard Spencer. He's one of the most prominent white supremacists in America and one of the organizers of the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville. Richard Spencer helped bring white supremacy and white nationalism out of the shadows. But I want you to meet a man who knows this world well and who's trying to do something about it. His name is Christian Piccolini. He was recruited into a skinhead group when he was just 14 years old. He went on to lead the Hammerskin Nation, which is the most violent neo-Nazi group in America. And then he had a change of heart. He left the movement at age 22. He told Charles Monroe Kane he's dedicated his life to getting others out of extremist hate.
People are not born as extremists, and that ideology and dogma are not what are driving people to these movements. whether we're talking about the American white supremacist movement or the European white supremacist movement or even ISIS or perhaps even street gangs. I believe that young people are looking for a sense of identity, community, and purpose. And if we hit enough of what I call potholes, those things in life that just deviate our path, and sometimes we can't find our way around them without the proper guidance or support. And I do believe that we are facing a crisis right now where we are letting our young people down. And in droves, they are looking for meaning and oftentimes in very, very dark places.
Well, speaking of male leadership, you recently had an encounter with Richard Spencer. For listeners who don't know who Richard Spencer is, could you remind us who he is and tell us about your encounter with him?
Yeah, Richard Spencer is famously known as the Nazi who was punched by an Antifa member, or the person who said Hail Trump in D.C. after Trump won the election. And I think most people would recognize him as probably one of the most prominent faces and voices of this white supremacist movement in America today. And recently, in December of 2016, there was an incident in Whitefish, Montana. Most people don't know this, but he lives there about 50% of the time while he lives another 50% of the time in Virginia. And Richard Spencer's mother was involved with a Jewish real estate agent, and they had a falling out. A white supremacist website called the Daily Stormer attacked the Jewish community, published their names, their photos, their phone numbers online, and they received thousands and thousands of death threats and a threat of an armed march in their town. And Richard Spencer was a part of this terror that came to this community, and I was asked by the community to come speak to them because they wanted to understand what was happening.
Okay.
So I decided I was going to do a little trolling myself. I tweeted to Richard Spencer and I said, hey, I'm in your hometown. In fact, I'm speaking about you tonight. If you're in town, you should stop by. And I certainly never expected him to respond. But he showed up. And nobody really knew he was there. He kind of walked in when it was dark and just before I was about to start. And after I finished my talk and finished the Q&A, the last question I received was, obviously, you're aware of Richard Spencer and the damage he's done to our community. What would you say to him if you were standing right in front of you right now? And I simply just turned to the balcony in the audience and I spoke right to Richard. And I said, Richard, would you like to go out for a cup of coffee?
Hey, Richard.
So what do you think of the state of Israel?
Let's have some coffee. Let's talk.
Sure.
Okay.
We met for 2 hours after that.
There's video of that, of course, and I've seen it. You kept staying on him.
I think you're lost like I was for 8 years, and I want to know what set you down that path.
I agree with you that I and so many people are lost in the 20th century in the sense that we're deracinated. We don't have roots. We don't have a sense of who we are. And they're searching for something deeper and something real.
I don't think you hate anybody. I think you, deep down inside, have something about yourself that you hate.
In every situation that I've worked in with somebody, there is a level of trauma that they are dealing with that they perhaps don't even really know about or have never kind of tackled head on. It could be one of the things that led them down this path.
I did have a deep concept that something was wrong, that there wasn't meaning in my life. I wasn't part of something bigger than myself. I don't have some deep resentment towards Africans. I have a higher ideal of what the right white race can be. And I actually have a superhuman ideal. I'm not caught up in, you know, justice or security or comfort. I think what I do this fundamentally is because we need to explore the universe, and only we can do it.
Hang on a second.
Yeah.
Why even engage someone like that?
First of all, I've heard everything that he's going to say. I used to say it. And in fact, many times what I hear coming from people's mouths are things that I helped construct back in the 80s.
Right.
So when Richard would try and feed me with propaganda or try and shift the conversation to one of ideology, I would simply ask him a simple question like how his relationship was with his daughter or what's his relationship like with his father. And I think I did shock him a little bit because he, first of all, isn't used to being asked questions like that and probably has never really thought about how to answer them.
And also,
I think that's a very human fundamental need. I mean, I would agree with
you,
and I think you heard me even talk about that.
An elitist in the sense that, like, I could have called it quits after I got punched.
He comes from extreme privilege. He's very isolated. I believe he's struggling with an identity crisis. I think that there are a lot of issues at play there.
The fact is, like, I had a burst eardrum, I had a concussion. Mm-hmm. Like, it was fairly serious. And, you know, these people do want to kill me. They've come to my house. They talk about killing me. But I keep going.
Right.
And I'm willing to die.
You know, most people like to think of these people who do these awful things as monsters. Mm-hmm. And I was one of those people.
And you weren't a monster.
I wasn't a monster. I was a broken individual who was willing to do monstrous things to get attention. Most of the times, they're saying those things and they're blaming other people and they're wishing ill on the other because of things that happen in their lives, not necessarily perpetrated by those other people, but they're rationalizing their own pain, their own self-hatred, and they're projecting it onto other people to diminish their own pain.
Right.
If you just make somebody feel worse than you do, well, then of course you're better than them. Of course, at least you feel better than them.
I went down a path, and like you, I was passionate. I was willing to die for it. Mm-hmm. I was willing to do what it took to make the vision come to a reality. I hope that someday you will realize that what you're doing is not only hurting other people, it's also hurting you. Like, down the road, like, you don't think that this is something that's a cancer building up inside of you? This anger, this fear, this rhetoric, this trolling, even the toll that it takes on other people is eventually going to take a toll on you.
At one point, you ask him if you can hug him.
Nice meeting you. Can I give you a hug?
Yeah, well, you know, I wanted him to know that if there was ever a voice in his head that caused some confusion, that I would be, a welcoming, friendly ear for him to vent to.
I really enjoy talking to you. I do want to continue the conversation. Yeah. Someday you're going to mean that hug.
I did mean it.
So what, you're available now? He gives you a buzz once some 2 in the morning and says, oh my God, dude, I'm hurting. Like, I want to change. Help me out. Like, is that what you're there for him now?
You know, I think in theory I am there for him for that. It hasn't happened yet.
No, I know that.
We've had a couple of conversations since then that have not turned out quite so well.
Sure.
He still is so intent on acting like a 4-year-old and calling people fat and traitors.
Sure.
You know, I take it. I listen to those things. And I hope that there's a moment someday where he realizes and takes a step back from this moment of fame that he's experiencing and says, you know, my God, I've set this world on a course that is destructive, just like I did, just like I realized one day.
Yeah.
It may happen, it may not happen, but I can guarantee you that there aren't a whole lot of people that are willing to give him that chance.
No, right.
And if there's nobody willing to give him that chance, the chances of him going down a better path are slim to none.
Let's talk about that for a second. Well, how do you do it? So say it's me. I want to leave extremism. And I'm an extremist. Like, what's the first thing you do with me?
The first thing that I want to do is build a rapport with you. Most of the people in these types of movements are very untrusting. They don't trust government. They don't trust the media. They don't trust outsiders or who they consider the enemy. And to many of them, I am the enemy. I'm a traitor.
Right.
So I really try and establish that rapport. And I do that by not being argumentative.
It seems so complicated, I guess, to get out of hate.
It is. It is very complicated, not only because there's hard work to do, but because there's such a stigma around having been involved in this and the belief that some people have that once you've done that, you can never change. That is the biggest struggle for most people when they decide to leave is, you know, will people, no matter what I do, still judge me for what I've done? And of course, there's a lot of hard work involved. There's a lot of amends that need to be made and accountability.
But you're not talking like generally making amends. You're saying, look, you did this to this family. You need to go to this actual family or this person and make amends that way?
Sure. I've done that myself. I mean, I've identified people that I've hurt in the past and found them to make amends with them. But there are so many people that I hurt that I didn't know who they were. I mean, one story that really kind of hits me the most, just several months ago, somebody showed me a post that Dylann Roof had made on a website called Stormfront, which is a very large white supremacist website, and he had asked for the name of a band who had written these lyrics that he had heard on some program. As I read these lyrics, I recognized that they were my lyrics, and this was 4 months.
Ugh.
Yeah, this was 4 months before he walked into the Mother Emanuel Church and slaughtered 9 people. And you know, I couldn't help but feel partly responsible for what had happened.
Yeah.
So I know even 30 years later, after the amends that I've made, I still know that I planted all these seeds of hate many, many years ago that I will forever pull the weeds from.
How do you know when if a skinhead that you work with falls off the wagon? What do you do about that?
That's a really good question. Part of how I do address the ideological component, I'll introduce haters to people that they think that they hate. I've spent dozens of hours with Holocaust survivors and Holocaust deniers and Islamophobes and Muslim families and homophobes and LGBTQ communities. Because once you've met somebody that you think that you hate, and you realize suddenly that that hate has come from a demonization and it's suddenly destroyed with humanization, it's really hard to walk back from that. But, you know, it is a lot like drugs. It is a lot like alcohol, where you have to make sure that you're critically thinking all the time and don't fall back into that pattern of blaming the other for no other reason other than to make yourself feel better.
You know, I have one last question for you, and I want to flip the switch here a little bit. You, for many years, saw minorities and gays and Jewish people as the other, the person that you hated. I think for a lot of my listeners, people listening right now, they see the kid with the swastika on his neck as the one to hate. Mm-hmm. Tell her, what should we do with that guy? Because he makes me mad he scares me.
Yeah, well, we should be scared, because when people are lost in this ideology, myself included, we were capable of anything. I mean, there were times when I was very adamant about committing acts of violence and even mass acts of violence during that period. And what I can say is every single person in that movement, whether they are part of a group or a lone wolf or just indoctrinated online, has gotten to that point because they have felt marginalized or broken. And what I say is, for people who are marginalized, we cannot continue to marginalize them further, because that just pushes them further away.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not suggesting everybody hug a Nazi like I did with Richard Spencer, but we need to bring them in closer.
You know, I was thinking about your book, and I recently interviewed Arno Michaelis and some other people, and it seems like there was a cumulative effect of small acts of kindness. There wasn't some one moment in any of these stories where, like, oh, I'm not a Nazi anymore. It was these cumulative effects of compassion. And maybe I just need to, like, online or interactions with people, just show small acts of compassion. So maybe I contributed 5 years later to this person changing.
That's a great point. I saw somebody do that recently, and Sarah Silverman had a troll attack her and call her a really vulgar word. She replied and said, "How can I help you? After looking at your Facebook page, I've noticed that you're depressed. I've noticed that you're struggling with lower back pain that you've never been able to rectify. And you don't seem like you have a lot of friends. What can I do for you, friend?" And after just a couple of Twitter conversations with this guy, he came around and the world really started to support this person who had been nasty, just a nasty, nasty troll. And suddenly this person had found this compassion and this empathy and started to embrace it and changed his views. And actually now Sarah is in an ongoing communication with this person and their friends, and she's trying to help him with an education and with a doctor, and it's completely changed his view. So I think that these small acts of kindness, these pay it forward compassion moments, are really the key to eliminating hate.
Thank you very much for the work that you do.
That's my pleasure, Charles. Thank you so much.
No problem. Thank you. Bye-bye.
That's Charles Monroe Cain talking with Christian Piccolini. Christian co-founded Life After Hate, a nonprofit group that helps former extremists change. And you can watch the video of that conversation he had with Richard Spencer on our website. It's at ttbook.org. Coming up, from racism and hate to the utopian vision of Afrofuturism.
I think that Afrofuturism is this really wonderful way of planting seeds and slowly but surely shifting consciousness. But at the same time, I wanted to see how Afrofuturism can show up in our daily life and be used on a daily basis. And during that investigation, I began creating meditations from the sounds of suns and stars. ¶¶ the exact same time as this kind of artist self was developing out of the curator, I was investigating Alice Coltrane. She's from Detroit. I've been studying Hinduism. I'm thinking about the philosophies of Hinduism is just really beautiful. And so to find this Black woman who's from Detroit, who's a creative, who became Hindu, and then opened an ashram, that blew my mind. Alice Coltrane. She is the patron saint of Detroit.
And you can hear more after this. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. If you want to make a compelling case against cynicism, let's take Afrofuturism, the utopian philosophy and cultural movement. It was on full, gorgeous display in the recent blockbuster movie Black Panther, that vision of Wakanda, a technologically advanced Black civilization of wealth and power, rich in science and art and history. It was breathtaking, right? That's Afrofuturism. Artist and activist Ingrid LaFleur says it's not just a dream. She recently ran for mayor of Detroit as the Afrofuturist party candidate. She told Halima Shah that Afrofuturism is both cosmic and practical.
Ingrid, talk to me about Afrofuturism. For those of us for whom our understanding of Afrofuturism is limited to Black Panther, what is it?
You know, I think Black Panther is a great starting point, a great introduction. Why not? Why not? It's so fun and inspiring. And it really does investigate some hard truths and some hard realities about Black existence. That's what Afrofuturism does. It helps us to not only feel the glory of empowerment and the ability to manifest your visions and dreams. That is amazing. But it also helps us to investigate why we haven't been able to manifest those dreams, why we even need to be empowered in these particular ways. For those who are not Black, I think it's really important for people to become hyper aware of the present condition of the Black body and the history of that. And this isn't some blanket, please learn about the transatlantic slave trade, which everyone should know because our entire lives are affected by it. But I think it goes deeper. And Afrofuturism helps to kind of segment out those kind of finer points in a way that is not threatening. It's almost seductive. Like you want to move into this space of almost dystopia in order to reach the utopia.
You ran for mayor of Detroit as the Afrofuturist candidate. What happens when you root your politics in Afrofuturism?
I embody these politics. It doesn't matter. Afrofuturism couldn't have never been born, and I would still do the same thing that I'm doing. And I think I could speak for every Afrofuturist. This is just the way we live our lives. We honor our ancestors every moment of every day. We believe in empowering the Black body. You know, we believe in controlling our destinies and manifesting better futures for ourselves, our people, for humans in general. And so I think that having a basic sense of love for humanity, for me, that's what my political platform really was based on. Just basically, I don't think that city government should be creating any harm. So I really wanted to rectify that through my platform. But through co-creation sessions I held in my campaign office, I was able to create the plan of action. And that's when I really discussed how the systems in which we're living in an 85% Black city were never built to help Black bodies prosper or to dream or to ever serve or protect Black bodies. So we really need a new system. And that's when I introduced the idea of universal basic income to address our poverty issue using a cryptocurrency that Detroit would create, and then also using blockchain technology to create more efficiency in the city government.
I want to go back to something that you said earlier. You mentioned that Afrofuturism is about a new relationship to the Black body. Can you unpack what that means?
It's been well established now that there is a high level of fear of the Black body. And I specifically say Black body, not Black person, simply because it is just the visual of the Black body that triggers people. It is not your mind. It is not, you know, how you speak, or like, it's not your heart. is seriously, I see a Black body and I'm triggered and alarms go off. And it's really because society has trained us to view the Black body in a very particular way, as criminals, as lazy, as poor, as desperate, or a very long list of stereotypes that has limited the experience of the Black body and limited what kind of relationship can be had with a Black body. So Afrofuturism is this really beautiful way of talking about and centering the Black body, but in the most freeing way, to a point that you almost can't define Blackness within an Afrofuturist space. But then, you know, it is coded at the exact same time, so it speaks to us in a very particular way. That experience, whenever people come into contact with Afrofuturist art, music, fashion, they definitely are given now a new perspective of the Black body, what the Black body is thinking and creating and dreaming about. And so it creates more complexity and dimension to something that we've always rendered as flat.
And when I hear you talk, Afrofuturism sounds so optimistic. And I'm curious about what it took for you to come to the place that you're at right now, where you're able to reimagine a different world. I mean, do you ever feel like it was hard to think the way that you are when society has conditioned people to look at the Black body in a certain way for so long?
You know, I think this gets into maybe a double conscious kind of situation. This current world or reality does not prevent someone from imagining to a degree. I do understand that sometimes time and space is needed to imagine. But, and I am speaking as a Black person who was privileged enough to live in a majority Black city. So I definitely know that I had more space to be me and be Black because it was fully supported by my entire city. I don't think that it is necessarily challenging. It becomes a space of either escape sometimes, or it becomes a space of solutions. It's like, let me imagine and figure out how I can solve the dark things that come with being Black in this world and see if I can bring light using these other kinds of mechanisms and tools. But I think that people are always moving into another reality. They see themselves in all types of ways that we might not even know, that we might not even talk about. I love to, when I'm speaking, to ask how many people have superhero names. You'd be surprised how many hands go up. I think all of us are wanting to have that freedom to move in and out of these kind of imaginative spaces so that we can take a break and transcend, or we can say, well, what happened if this happens? You know, we can exercise all the magic we want to within those imaginative spaces.
Ingrid, my last question to you is, can you dream a future for us? Can you paint a verbal picture of what an Afrofuturist Detroit would look and feel and smell and taste like?
Well, I think that I already live in a far-off future.
Mm.
My community is already 3D printing, living completely off of cryptocurrency. My world is very futurist. I go to conferences about decolonizing Mars. I talk about life extension technology with people. So I think that my community is quite futurist all into itself. And so what I would like, I think my future vision is an expansion of the work that they're already doing. I would like Detroit to be completely off the grid. I would like everyone to have water, to have access to fresh gardens. I would love a higher level of digital literacy. I'm really excited about if we do give every single youth in Detroit the opportunity to be exposed to all this amazing technology, AI, VR, blockchain, everything. I want to know what they're going to create. I'm excited about the unexpected. I want to just put the tools in people's hands, make sure that they have access to what they want, and I want to see what they manifest. And that would be, for me, my vision, just to make sure people have the opportunity.
Ingrid Liffler is an artist, activist, and Afrofuturist based in Detroit. She was a recent Detroit mayoral candidate, and she's the founder and director of Afrotopia. Halima Shah talked with her. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you every week from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. Charles Monroe Kane produced today's show. He had help from Mark Rickers, Shannon Henry Kleiber, and Halima Shah. Joe Hartke is our sound designer and technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening. Come back next time.
That's just the way you make me feel. That's just the way you make me feel.